History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we really need to hear. We don't want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Oceanside, California with 99-year-old George Coburn. He'll turn 100 this coming October, but we're going to talk about where he was on that day of infamy many years ago. And we'll start even before that. George, you're born in Minnesota, but grew up here in the San Diego area. What was it like here in the 1930s? And you're one of seven children in your family. What was that childhood like?
San Diego was a small town. Commercial fishing was the biggest industry, and the aircraft industry, which became really a major thing later, was just getting started when I was a youngster. They built a lot of airplanes here, both military and commercial planes.
And what kinds of things were you up to as a boy? What were the things that kept you busy? Because I know you're still busy at 99. You're doing lapidary work with your great-grandson. So you must have been a pretty busy boy back then.
I was a busy boy, yeah, but I wasn't doing anything productive. I loved to get out in the back country, we had a lot of wide open space back then, and there's an area now called Padre Trails Park, and I used to wander around that area before it became a park, and I'd camp there, and we had our campfires, and which are now illegal. Needless to say, things have changed.
And how'd you get along with all your siblings? Since you were one of the younger ones, did they pick on you at all?
No, I didn't have any problem. Actually, the first three were half-brothers. My mother had an early marriage, and she had three children by that marriage. When the third child was born, her husband disappeared, and she married Coburn after she came out here. They were both bakers, and surprising thing, Mom came from Australia. Her folks immigrated from Denmark to Australia for free land, and also because their home in Denmark was right on the German border, and there was a lot of controversy going on about who owned this land, who did it belong to, and they were happy to go out to the Great Outback, as it was called, and they were in Queensland. The reason they came to America was they had a drought, California style. It went on for years and years, and the productivity of the land dropped so low that they couldn't keep animals anymore, and they couldn't sustain themselves, so they left. And Grandpa heard that Minnesota was a land of 10,000 lakes, and that's why I was born in Minnesota. Because he said, that's the place for me. But we wound up in San Diego because Mom was a victim of the Spanish flu, which was epidemic at the time. Her doctor told her, you got to get out of Minnesota or you won't survive. So Dad sent her out here. Let me go back a couple of years. Dad was the ship's baker on the ship that Mom came to America on. They didn't meet at that time, but Mom also became a baker, and they met through their vocation in Minnesota. Unlikely sequence of events, but
yeah, what are the odds of that? And when did they figure that out, that he had been the baker on the ship she came over on?
Well, because they talked about her immigrating, so he probably asked what ship. Dad was a character. He was apprenticed to a baker in Kentucky, where he was born, and he was mistreated pretty badly, apparently, and he ran away, 12 years old. And he made his way. I don't know very much of his early life, but as a young man, he went to Alaska for the gold rush, and damn near died of starvation up there. Didn't find any appreciable amount of gold. I don't know how he wound up in Minnesota and ultimately met my mother, and they had a pretty good life together, though. Although he died fairly young. I was about 10 years old when he passed away.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but just listening to that, I'm thinking it was a minor miracle that you were ever born. I mean, for your mom to come from Australia, end up in Minnesota, meet the guy who was the baker on the ship who she came over on, but he ran away from Kentucky, gone to Alaska looking for gold, and somehow they meet in Minnesota, or else you're not here right now.
Well, I got here. I'm not questioning it. I have to accept what comes.
Well, and almost a century later, here we are. Well, and you mentioned that, your father dying when you're 10 years old.
Yeah.
That can't be easy for a 10-year-old to process, and it couldn't have been easy on your family, especially entering into the Great Depression right then.
Yeah, the Great Depression was a real factor. Happily, the oldest of my half-siblings, he worked for the county of San Diego, and he was a surveyor. He maintained the family. To me, he was a father figure. He was about 10 years older than me, and if we wanted to do something that required special permission, we have to ask Ed.
Well, and Ed, like you, would go on to serve in World War II. But what about those Depression years? Because most people alive today, I mean, we see hard times and we see things around the world that are devastating. But I don't know if we can really grasp what it must have been like for you guys and how tough the times were. Are there some examples that you recall that illustrate kind of the gravity of those years?
Well, I worked at whatever I could earn a nickel and a dime at. I sold magazines and I had a paper route, and so I always had a nickel and a dime to rub together. Getting a real job was difficult. After I was out of high school, somebody told my mom about a job that she knew was coming up, and it was a do-everything boy on a used car lot, and paid 25 cents an hour. And I went down and I got that job. I was still working there when I went into the Navy. I figured the Navy was a lot more solid position than that boy on the car lot.
And you joined the Navy in 1938, 3 years before America's drawn into World War II. Why'd you do that? What was it about the Navy that made you decide to sign up?
Well, San Diego was primarily a Navy town, and the way it happened, I didn't have any idea about joining the Navy. I hadn't given it a thought, but one day my good friend Perry, who I went camping and hunting with, came by and he says, "Hey, George, I'm going down to join the Navy. Why don't you come with me?" And I said, "Are you crazy, Perry?" And he talked to me, and finally I went and asked the boss if I could have a couple hours off, and my intent at that time was I would just go down with Perry and keep him company while he sacrificed his life for the Navy. But as it worked out, I got in the Navy and Perry didn't. Perry had a police record, and it was kind of strange the way it happened. But Perry liked horses, and he was down in Mission Valley near Lakeside, and he found a horse wandering around without any attention. And so he jumped on the horse and was riding it, and the people looking for the horse were a little bit unhappy with Perry because they thought that he had stolen the horse, and he got charged with that. The sad part of that, from Perry's point of view, was the horse belonged to the deputy sheriff out there.
So you're telling me you got tricked into joining the Navy by a horse thief. Is that your story?
That's my story, yeah.
Well, so you end up in the Navy. What were you expecting? What did you think was going to happen?
In the Navy? I looked at the Navy as a job, and I kind of enjoyed the Navy. The routine didn't bother me at all, and I didn't have any real plans as far as my Navy career was concerned, because I had good grades in mathematics primarily. I was put into the fire control division, and that became my career focus in the Navy. And I became a chief fire controlman in a matter of about 3 years, which was pretty unusual. And after a year as chief, they promoted me to an officer rank. So one day the gunnery officer called me up to his room and he says, "Coburn, we want to promote you." He says, "What do you want to be? You want to be an ensign or a warrant officer?" And I said, "I want to be a warrant officer, because to me, the warrant officer was the top of a pyramid and the ensign was on the very bottom." So about a month later, my commission came back and I was an ensign.
Well, I know we're going to talk about December 7th, 1941, and you were in a place that we have very few people remaining today that were there to experience it. But what about the time before that? You're on the USS Oklahoma, this battleship, before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand what that everyday Navy life out on the islands was like?
It was kind of boring. As a matter of fact, Linda has cited one of my letters home in which I said, "Yesterday was boring and today is just like yesterday and tomorrow will be just like today." And then I said, "Something's bound to happen soon." And this was just about 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor. And something did happen. By the time Pearl Harbor came about, I had become the head fire controlman on the anti-aircraft battery. And that morning on December 7th, I was in the plotting room cutting in circuits to the anti-aircraft directors. I was going to go up, it was working day for me. I was going to go up and run tests on the directors to be sure they were performing as they should, because we had a big inspection coming up the next 3 days, and I didn't want to get special citation.
So you're thinking, I got to make sure all these anti-aircraft guns are working so we don't fail inspection. And you had no idea that there was an enemy that was bearing down on you, was going to show up that morning. Did anyone, was there ever any talk of could be at war?
Yeah, we talked about the possibility of a war with Japan. And because, you know, Japan was in the news quite a bit. They were pretty aggressive in their dealings with their neighbors, and people in the United States thought that was improper, and probably was. But anyway, that's about as deep as the conversation got on it. I mean, we never really discussed it in depth, and what if, and nobody had any idea. Even the top brass in the Navy didn't think that torpedoes could be used in Pearl Harbor. They said it's too shallow. The Japanese developed a shallow running torpedo, and they also made some kind of special adapter to where the torpedo wouldn't dive and hit the bottom when it was launched off an aircraft.
And he would feel the impact of the first torpedo to strike the battleship USS Oklahoma on December 7th, 1941. We'll talk about that when we come back. You heard George Coburn mention Linda, and that's Dr. Linda Dudick, a retired history professor who's working with him on a book about his experiences in the Navy in World War II, not only escaping the sunken USS Oklahoma on December 7th, but also his time the rest of the war on the decorated heavy cruiser USS Louisville. at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can find a short video of George describing how he made it off his capsized battleship. And he'll walk us through it step by improbable step when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.